specter of the major questions doctrine will have a chilling effect. I feel like it's the boogeyman. It takes years to get through the litigation process, and an agency just might be more conservative from the outset in order to avoid being struck down. You know, that's just the opposite of the bold action we need to protect our health and safety.
The Supreme Court just wrapped up its latest term with a series of high-profile and controversial decisions, including on West Virginia versus EPA. Last Thursday, June 30th, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the pollution control system the EPA employed as the basis for the Obama administration's 2015 Clean Power Plan was outside its authority to regulate emissions from power plants. Now that's a mouthful. What does it mean? And perhaps more importantly, what comes next? I'm Julia Piper, and this is Political Climate, a podcast on energy and environmental issues in America and around the world, presented by the USC Schwarzenegger Institute and in partnership with Canary Media. We're back today with my co-host Shane Skelton, an advisor on energy, infrastructure, and environmental policy issues at Boundary Stone Partners, and an expert on all things happening on Capitol Hill. Hello, Shane. How are you today?
Doing great, Julia. Thanks for the kind introduction. I'm excited for this discussion. I'm excited to hear from Jay. I mean, if people have been listening to this podcast for a few years, they'll know that we were talking about the Clean Power Plan way back when and how the courts might rule on these issues moving forward, whether it would make it to the Supreme Court and what that means for, you know, how Congress has to fulfill its duties if some of these things are struck down. So I'm actually real excited for today's discussion.
Well, you mentioned Jay there. In a moment, we will be joined by Jay Duffy, an attorney with the Clean Air Task Force, who represented the American Lung Association, the American Public Health Association, Appalachian Mountain Club, Clean Air Council, Clean Wisconsin, and several others in the West Virginia versus EPA case at the Supreme Court. So we'll bring him in just a moment. First, I just wanted to note how much coverage there's been of this Supreme Court case on the EPA. Of course, there was the Roe v. Wade decision, which captured a lot of headlines, but this environmental case was pretty high profile too, because it may actually extend beyond even the EPA. There were headlines like shocking and disgraceful, Supreme Court ruling sparks anger from Democrats and environmentalists. There was a Guardian headline that said, global dismay as Supreme Court leaves Biden's climate policy in tatters. Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan wrote the liberal minority's dissent in the case, and she did not mince words. She said, quote, whatever else this court may know about, it does not have a clue about how to address climate change. And let's say the obvious, the stakes here are high. Now, conservative leaders applauded the decision for reining in regulatory overreach. In the majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts explained that under this ruling, an agency like the EPA, quote, must point to a clear congressional authorization when it seeks to regulate a significant portion of the American economy. So, Shane, we're going to get into the legal expertise here and more of the context, but this point about congressional authorization makes me think about, you know, we're due for another check-in on reconciliation, the idea that Democrats might actually pass a big climate and clean energy plan, you know, coming up here. Because while we're talking about the Supreme Court and the EPA, Congress is unavoidable. So what is our quick status update on Congress, Shane?
My goodness, it is so difficult to tell, right? You can talk to people across the Senate specifically, which is sort of where the process lies at this moment. And people are optimistic, right? I mean, I look at a calendar that's dwindling. Just as a quick reminder to our listeners, September 30th is a hard deadline, not a hypothetical one. That's when the reconciliation authority expires. And so you start to reverse engineer the calendar and you're getting pretty tight. Having said that, leaders across the Senate are confident they're going to get something done. As of this morning, they sent certain provisions on drug pricing reform to the parliamentarian. The reason that matters for our listeners is because every single provision in this bill is going to have to clear the parliamentarian. And the parliamentarian is going to determine whether or not these provisions violate the Byrd rule. And the Byrd rule is a set of structures that govern what can be done through this reconciliation process, which is primarily a budgeting tool, and what needs to be done through regular order. And so that process takes a couple weeks. The early part of that process is Democrats putting these provisions in front of the parliamentarian, you know, arguing for why they're compliant and getting feedback. The second part of that process is more akin to litigation, whereby Republicans can challenge specific provisions and debate whether or not they're compliant with the Byrd rule. So the fact that they're starting that process, even if only on a small piece of the bill, signals that they are very serious about moving forward. It's unclear whether they've reached agreement on the climate provisions, and reporting as of this morning was that they have not, but they are beginning the parliamentarian review, which is a very serious and meaningful step. And so closer than we've been since last, you know, November to seeing progress here. But I also wouldn't advise that folks hold their breath. I think we're going to see a couple more twists and turns over the next few weeks.
All right. Lots hangs in the balance here. And I think we'll come back to the role of Congress and how important it is that Congress act in order to direct what the agencies do. But of course, the Biden administration may not give up on agency action entirely. And we'll hear more about that coming up in just a moment with Jay Duffy, attorney at the Clean Air Task Force.
A decade ago, Californians started a climate action movement and launched MCE, the state's first community choice energy provider. Community choice providers empower local communities to make their own decisions about the source of their electricity. Today, MCE offers nearly 40 Bay Area communities almost twice as much renewable energy as the state average. The power of MCE is about more than clean energy. It's the power of people over profit. Learn more at mceCleanEnergy.org.
Jay, welcome to Political Climate. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I imagine it's been quite a busy past few weeks or months for you.
It certainly has. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here, but you're right. It has been very busy. waiting and refreshing SCOTUS's website to see when this opinion would drop and then trying to figure out what it means.
What's it like to be a lawyer representing all these interests at the Supreme Court? Do you go in person? It sounds intimidating. I'm just curious if you could set the scene.
Sure. It's fantastic. I have a wide swath of clients kind of from the American Lung Association, one of the, foremost national public health organizations, to folks like the Appalachian Mountain Club and the Clean Air Council, who is, a smaller local Philadelphia group who works on climate change locally there. So it's a real kind of broad and diverse set of interests. And it's, great to be able to bring those collection of voices up to the Supreme Court. But no, nobody's in person. Only the folks who argued before the Supreme Court were in person. I argued a portion of the case before the DC Circuit last year, and that was in and of itself an extraordinary event. It was a 9-hour Zoom call. So I am hoping that this podcast is not quite as lengthy.
We will definitely not go for 9 hours, but that sounds challenging. Let's just rewind the clock here a little bit. I would like you to start by giving us a little history. Our listeners follow the climate policy space. They will surely be familiar with the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which was central to this West Virginia versus EPA case. And they'll probably also remember that the Clean Power Plan doesn't really exist anymore. It was repealed and replaced by the Trump administration. So why did the Supreme Court even take up this case with the Clean Power Plan at its core?
That's a really good question, and one we asked the court and tried to dissuade them from taking it, in opposing the petition for cert, as well as in our briefing. This case has a really bizarre posture, as you mentioned. In 2015, EPA establishes the Clean Power Plan. The Supreme Court in 2016, actually in the last act of Justice Scalia, stayed the Clean Power Plan. It never went into effect. So in the meantime, the power sector, they met the Clean Power Plan targets, the 2030 goals by 2019 with no rule in place at all. All of the deadlines for the rule have passed and no one at the DC Circuit, including the EPA and, all the environmental and public health organizations, nobody wanted this outdated plan to come back into effect. It was strange that the court took it, but nonetheless, the majority opinion found that this case, that it wasn't moot because in the future, EPA could rely on generation shifting, which I'm sure your listeners know is kind of the system of emission reduction that EPA relied on in the Clean Power Plan. And a majority opinion pretty explicitly indicated that the decision is advisory, which, doesn't fall well under Article 3 of the Constitution, that basically it was advising EPA on what it could do in the next rulemaking. Not finding harm from, the rulemaking before it, the Clean Power Plan repeal, but saying, EPA could in the future rely on generation shifting, and we want to make sure they don't do that. That was a really breathtakingly broad view taken by the court that surprised us all.
So in summary, the court was sort of projecting into the future of regulations and approaches the EPA might take, and that's what made this so unique of a ruling. Is that right?
That's right.
And generation shifting, this would be the EPA requiring, say, a power plant to go from coal to solar one day, or for the owners of that power plant to do that. That's not the crux of the issue.
But it's even a little more nuanced than that, as is everything, right? The EPA comes up with a system of emission reduction. Say, you know, here in the, under the Clean Power Plan, it was generation shifting, which is the, you know, most cost-effective and efficient way that the industry has been reducing its emissions for decades. And then they came up with an emission limit. And then, you know, there's a lot of series of actions here, which is why it's so strange that the major questions doctrine is utilized here, because EPA comes up with an emission limit. And then they say, hey, states, look at your power plants and send us a plan that demonstrates, you know, how they can meet that emission limit. And then each power plant gets to decide how exactly they're going to meet that emission limit. So, you know, the fact that the court was so interested in the system of emission reduction, which would ultimately, after a number of steps, lead to a power plant having a standard placed on it by which it could meet, you know, through a number of ways, was pretty surprising.
So just to dig a little further, I know that there's discussion around this major questions doctrine, and that was brought up in the majority opinion as part of the ruling and the decision making here. Can you explain what that is and why it factors in so importantly?
It's difficult to describe the major questions doctrine during oral argument. Each justice seemed to have their own take on what it meant, but I can kind of generally set it up and say where it's landed here. So, you know, generally Congress, they write broad legislation with instructions to the agencies, you know, as to the factors to consider when they're promulgating rules. Congress, you know, doesn't have the in-house expertise to know how to best deal with the nuances and the problems facing our society, but they know that they want clean air and water, safe workplaces, honest banks. So they task these agencies with crafting solutions without overly encumbering our economy or electric reliability and the like. They intend that these laws last for decades and are able to deal with new and evolving problems and solution. So this decision, the West Virginia decision, adds some uncertainty to that design. Now, if a solution is new or big or involves some other factors that result in crossing the quote unquote major questions threshold, the agency is now going to need to find clear authorization for the rule in the statute. While there's hope that broad language will still be respected and that there won't be many things that cross that threshold, it's hard to know where that line is.
So what I'm hearing here is that this decision kind of puts the onus back on Congress to pass laws and potentially even be more detailed in what they write. And so I guess there could be an argument that maybe Congress feels empowered to do more. But I'm curious what you think of that.
So, you know, I'm no legislative expert as far as the inner workings of Congress, but I have not seen a flurry of legislation coming out of this Congress to deal with major problems. The Harvard Election Law Clinic, they filed an amicus brief in this case, essentially arguing that the idea of enforcing the major questions doctrine more stringently, that by doing that, you'll create some more congressional accountability, that's essentially a legal fiction, that, you know, Congress kind of is where it is right now, and that by forcing them to be more specific, that's not going to urge additional laws dealing with big problems. You know, and there is 192 members of Congress who also submitted an amicus brief, you know, saying that all the authority EPA needed for the Clean Power Plan was already found in the Clean Air Act, and that, you know, requiring Congress to act even more legislation for every emerging problem would be unworkable. You know, the design for a long time has been to rely on this expertise, and that's where you want these sorts of major problems is where you want the most expertise. There's a lot of in-house, you know, scientists and engineers at all of these agencies that can deal with these kind of emerging problems and understand how to craft solutions such that, you know, we get the best result without imposing too much cost or problems on society. So I would think that we would want to continue to utilize that knowledge. So I don't know exactly how Congress deals with this decision.
Shane, I want to bring you in here. You work a lot with Congress. What is your read on this? And maybe what are you hearing in more conservative circles around, you know, the benefits of this ruling? Or at least, do you think this does put more, you know, momentum behind Congress potentially?
I think momentum is definitely not the right word. You know, we hear a lot, and I remember when the Clean Power Plan was announced, I was working on the Hill at the time. And at the time, conventional wisdom, at least on the Hill, was that it would be stayed and eventually thrown out because we couldn't, at least at that time, identify the explicit authority to basically, you know, provide fleet-wide guidance to power generators as opposed to inside the fence line. I think, you know, there's pros and cons here. The reality of it is that Americans of every political stripe are growing increasingly frustrated with the Supreme Court and how the Supreme Court has become a vacuum of power. And that's true of conservatives when they see rulings as insufficiently conservative. The Affordable Care Act is a good example. It's obviously true of progressives and some of the more recent rulings. And so I think if there's one sort of bipartisan feeling across America, is that way too much power is in the Supreme Court. The problem, and I think the issue, is that that's because Congress hasn't enacted, you know, many major statutes. Energy legislation specifically usually comes about once a decade at best. There was the Energy Act of 2020, which funded some cool programs. But really, the last sort of overhaul of energy policy was probably the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And so Congress needs to fill that void. Congress needs to address, you know, the problems of the day. But Congress is gridlocked, and politics are a tricky beast. And so I'm a little reluctant to say we should look at these statutes and just sort of imply intent decades into the future, because I think people change, moods change, science that we understand changes. And so I wish Congress would enact a law that's tailored at reducing power sector emissions. I wish Congress would enact a law that's tailored to reducing transportation sector emissions. I wish Congress would enact really thoughtful legislation that would allow, you know, continued investment in the clean energy economy and create some off-ramps, right? Whether that's creating certified offset programs or different ways for companies to deal with emissions in a way that's good for the environment and also good for the economy. I think all of us agree that there are plenty of options out there, but it's tough to say that the Supreme Court, you know, should just allow administrative agencies to do what they want to do, because in my view, that's not the way our system's set up. And our system is set up intentionally to inspire gridlock. I mean, and that's noted back in our founding documents in the Federalist Papers prior to the Constitution. So it certainly is a system meant for gridlock. It's meant for very, very slow incremental change. But that is not well suited for tackling the climate crisis that we face today and some of the changes that we need, especially, you know, in this gridlocked environment. So I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying I'm glad nothing's happening, but just that our system is slow and clunky and bulky. And I think anyone who's been watching reconciliation for the last 2 years with just single party rule has still seen how arduous this process can be.
Yeah, there's been some polling out to your earlier point about confidence in the Supreme Court sinking to a historic low. That was according to Gallup. Also, I think there's just been some inconsistency. You know, you hear and read about issues like, you know, taking away states' rights on, say, gun regulation, but then empowering states to fully control, say, reproductive rights. And so there's some inconsistency that starts to bring in all the political arguments. And again, here in EPA, we'll see how this plays out and maybe has other implications for even other elements of the U.S. Government. But sticking to this specific EPA ruling for a moment, Shane, do you think there was some merit in trying to address the issue with the Clean Power Plan specifically? Was there an overreach there? I know we talked about Congress and the need for them to act, but flipping to the agency side, the EPA and what you know about it, should they have designed that rule differently? And do you think there's a lesson here going forward?
You know, what I would have advised, and I've never worked in an administration, whether EPA, DOE, the White House, or otherwise. So I am a creature of Congress, and my bias is probably showing in my answers here. But back then, when we were looking at the rule as it was proposed, we were all very confused as to why they didn't just go for a very restrictive inside the fence line approach. That authority is clear in the statute. You could, you know, really tighten the screws. I guess some would question what the best system of emissions reduction is. So they probably would have been challenged in court either way to say it's too costly, or the technology to get emissions down to this level or increase, you know, facility efficiency this much doesn't exist. But my read, and I am not, you know, opposite of Jay, I am not a litigator, and I'm a fake lawyer, you know, in by nature, if I have a piece of paper on my wall that says I am, but that's about it. But I always viewed it as inside the fence line was the way to go. And, you know, I think at least on Capitol Hill, back when the Clean Power Plan was proposed, we had a pretty good sense that it wasn't going to stand.
Interestingly, Shane, that when we were litigating this case, you know, we saw generation shifting as kind of the most cost-effective way that things were happening in the industry and the industry preferred method of doing this. And, you know, you'll note that there were no power companies before the Supreme Court saying that, you know, they wanted to appeal the DC Circuit's ruling. But even in our briefing, we recognized that there was some novelty to the Clean Power Plan. We said, you know, to the extent that you've created some sort of, you know, crediting mechanism and kind of pulled in renewables and non-Clean Air Act covered sources, maybe that's where EPA went a little too far. And we thought that you could kind of lop that off without expanding this major questions doctrine, you know, kind of saying the same sort of things that have been said in the past, which is this a decision for EPA to make? Is this in their lane? That's kind of how the major questions doctrine had been utilized up to this date. And you could easily say, you know, these aren't even, you know, these are non-polluting sources that you've created a formal role for in the Clean Power Plan. So that's outside of your authority. But instead, they kind of expanded the major questions doctrine to this sort of grab bag of factors to determine whether something's major. And if it is major, you need to show a clear statement of authority in the Clean Air Act or whatever act you are, the agency is operating under, that exact rule is permitted. You know, not that it's just within your discretion to make a decision over this issue, because of course, you know, EPA has the authority over power plants and over greenhouse gases. We've seen that in prior cases, but here that wasn't enough authority. They needed to actually show that the Clean Power Plan was clearly authorized. And that's a step in expansion of this sort of major questions doctrine.
Yeah, that does seem disconcerting. And I guess maybe fueling some of the headlines we've seen about, you know, what this means for climate action more broadly. And so, Jay, walk us through that. Just how big of an impact do you see this particular ruling having on what the EPA can do to regulate carbon emissions?
Sure. So to me, the more troubling part of this opinion is the major questions doctrine. I actually think in the Clean Air Act lane, the system of emission reduction that was taken off the table was this, you know, generation shifting system of emission reduction. In 2014, the Obama EPA found that, you know, CCS, carbon capture and sequestration, is the best system of emission reduction for new coal plants. And so even today, if a new coal plant was to be built, the standard that it would have to meet would be based on CCS. And in the Clean Power Plan, the Obama administration said, you know, we've looked at co-firing, you know, zero carbon fuels and natural gas as a system. We've looked at carbon capture and sequestration, and they meet all the hallmarks and criteria of, you know, it's Section 111 here that we're under the Clean Air Act. It meets all of those factors. But, you know, it would be cheaper to do it. We think that even if we set a standard based on CCS or co-firing, that the sources are going to comply through generation shifting. So, you know, why don't we just cut to the chase and have it be based, have the system be generation shifting? So, you know, I think there is a path forward here to set stringent emission standards for the power sector.
Interesting. So that could be, like you said, carbon capture, sequestration, not generation shifting, but setting rules like that, or maybe carbon trading. I guess, what are the other tools in the EPA's toolkit still?
It's hard to tell this opinion, you know, as much as it kind of in dicta discusses various tools, trading, co-firing. In the dissent, they talk about CCS. They don't talk about it in the majority opinion. So there's a lot of kind of discussion, and I think we're going to want to read some of the tea leaves as far as whether, you know, what kind of market mechanisms are still available, et cetera. But the ruling is really narrow, and it literally says this is a narrow opinion. We are only saying that the system that was underlying the Clean Power Plan was not clearly authorized by Congress, and therefore it's impermissible. So there are a lot of tools left. And, you know, there are also other ways to address climate pollutants. You know, there are climate pollutants coming from other sectors, the oil and gas industry. There's some proposed standards out there right now that are, you know, very at the source, bread and butter, traditional standards. You know, the entire industrial source category, there's no regulations for industrial sources in the United States right now for their greenhouse gases. So there are other pathways to reduce emissions. And as I said, you know, there we still have, I still think stringent standards can be based on the sort of inside the fence approaches. And actually, Clean Air Task Force provided, you know, when the Clean Power Plan was proposed, our comments were, you know, hey, as an alternative, there's a way to get there based on these sort of inside the fence approaches as well. So we've been thinking in that lane for quite some time.
That's interesting because I think it's a good follow-up headline to some of the, you know, outrage around taking a tool out of the toolkit to say, but there's still a lot the EPA can do. It can still regulate emissions from, say, coal plants, which we know are still polluting. So that is, I guess, the silver lining here. And we'll have to see what the Biden administration does, because I think they've been waiting in the wings to see what happened with this decision to come out with a new power plant rule. And as you said, there's lots of other types of emissions they could start to tackle. And do you anticipate, Jay, that the EPA will start to take more action now that we have this ruling out?
I think so. I mean, we've been encouraging them to move swiftly. They have a regulatory agenda that says that there will be proposed rules for new and existing gas and coal plants in March of 2023. So we'll continue to work with them to provide them, you know, with all the record evidence that, you know, these inside the fence approaches can achieve, you know, dramatic reductions and are cost reasonable and within all the parameters of what's required under the Clean Air Act.
Jay, you said earlier that, you know, the Clean Power Plan goals were actually hit, and they were hit 11 years ahead of schedule. So I think it's an interesting point that the private sector continues to act in decarbonizing, at least the power sector. Shane, do you have any thoughts on that, about the trends that are happening around these regulations we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't see anyone pulling back on trying to move to a clean energy economy. And that's sort of where, you know, I want to see a more robust Congress-enacted system that facilitates what we're seeing in the private sector. But the reality of it is companies want to move this direction. Capital markets are going this direction. Utilities are making these commitments. Energy consumers are making these commitments. I think the trend line is going to hold steady. Regs are interesting, right, because they force a very specific action or set of actions and you're legally accountable for them. But I actually think almost all stakeholders, obviously, you know, not individuals who make their profit margin off of producing and burning fossil fuels. But other than that, I really think these trend lines are going to hold steady. I rarely talk to anyone in any industry who isn't trying, or at least, you know, trying to be creative about how they're going to continue to deploy more clean energy or use cleaner energy or increase their efficiency. I don't think the trends are going anywhere. I do think where government could step in is to provide, you know, some sort of level playing field, to provide some certainty, some threshold, some sort of neutral government arbiter on, you know, how to go about doing all this. You know, offsets are a great example. What is an offset? You know, do we need to make sure that they're actually reducing atmospheric CO2 concentrations? Can you compete in the marketplace? Right now, if you can get a solar deployment out there that would cost less, it's still difficult in certain parts of the country where there aren't energy markets to build that facility. So I think the trends aren't going away. We just need some policy to provide the framework or infrastructure to allow these trends to continue and even accelerate.
Well, sort of to that point, after this Supreme Court decision came out on the EPA, you saw members of the U.S. Climate Alliance. It's an association of 24 governors working to curb greenhouse gas emissions. And they said in a statement that the decision, quote, only hardens our resolve to act with the boldness and urgency the climate crisis demands. And they underscored the importance of state action, this being an association of governors. And they pointed out that their alliance already has 22 members with clean energy standards for electricity. 18 members have 100% zero carbon or carbon neutral electricity goals. 14 of them have economy-wide net zero emissions goals, and 12 participate in carbon market programs. So that's just at the state level and what's on the books today. Unclear, though, what that will catalyze in terms of future action. Here in California, Governor Newsom said he wants to quadruple down on climate. I guess, Jay, do you have a read on how states might be emboldened by this Supreme Court decision? Is there anything new or interesting you see happening on that level? Or is this just more statements and posturing in a sense of momentum coming out of the Supreme Court term?
The decision doesn't say anything about the power of the states and local authorities, and they retain the same sort of power they have to address climate change and reduce emissions from their fleet. So, you know, I think other than exactly what you kind of just alluded to is spurring some political will to take action into their own hands. There's nothing actually about this opinion that would prevent folks from moving forward on the local level.
Political Climate is brought to you by MCE. MCE was California's first community choice energy provider. For more than 10 years, MCE has helped communities across the Bay Area source significantly more renewable energy than the state average. Nearly 40 communities are now a part of MCE, and together they're leading on climate action for a brighter future. But the power of MCE is about more than clean energy. It's the power of people over profit. It's community power. MCE's efforts on climate justice have helped vulnerable communities gain access to electric vehicles, energy storage, and energy savings. By building and buying more renewable energy, MCE puts the power back in your hands. We all deserve a fossil-free future that combats climate change and prioritizes energy equity. Learn more and take action at mceCleanEnergy.org.
What about moving forward in other areas? So we talked about this being a narrow decision, but it also has this wide-ranging element with the point about the major questions doctrine. So I've seen things like the Security and Exchange Commission's new pending rules for disclosing climate risk from investors and private companies. That type of rule could be called into question in light of this Supreme Court decision. So do you see other ripple effects like that?
I definitely do. I fear that even where agencies do have clear authority, the specter of the major questions doctrine will have a chilling effect. I feel like it's the boogeyman. It takes years to get through the litigation process, and an agency just might be more conservative from the outset in order to avoid being struck down. You know, that's just the opposite of the bold action we need to protect our health and safety.
Are there specific cases coming up that we should be watching for that could be affected in this way?
I think there are. The light duty vehicle standards case, which is currently in the DC circuit. I'm actually representing clients in that as well. And we received the statement of issues. And of course, the major questions doctrine is there. You know, the idea that you can't make standards based on switching fleets to electric. You know, and as you mentioned, this SEC climate disclosure, you know, the SEC does have authority to, you know, standardize climate disclosures to investors and make sure that investors have all the material information that they need in order to make good investments. And, you know, now climate change is material. It has an economic impact. But of course, you know, the buzzword of climate change came up. So opponents have been crying major questions. This also came up with the issue of the social cost of carbon. The Biden administration issued draft guidance on the cost of carbon. It hasn't even yet used that cost in a rulemaking. So the court struck it down as too early, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it again. And then over the winter, we saw a couple of cases that dealt with agencies responding to the pandemic. Some have joked that the brightest line for when something is a major question or not is if it deals with a pandemic or climate change.
Oh, fun. So it's a term we're all going to have to get very used to in the climate space, the major questions doctrine.
Right.
And I'm sure there are major questions that people will continue to have about what exactly it means. I want to end by turning to a broader question about the legal system and having it as a tool to advance action on climate. Shane mentioned earlier, there's not much confidence in the Supreme Court these days. We are living this hyper-politicized moment here in the U.S., in other parts of the world, we do see the courts being used. Shell famously lost a case in the Netherlands that ordered the company to slash carbon emissions. Other damages have been filed against oil and gas companies. Jay and then Shane, I'd love to know, what do you think the role of the courts is in shaping climate and decarbonization goals, if any? Is this a tool that advocates should be looking to or opponents should be relying on?
It's interesting you mentioned that, in 2011, states and conservation groups sued a number of power companies under a theory of public nuisance, saying that greenhouse gas emissions were causing them harm. And they wanted a cap and trade imposed on the companies. And the Supreme Court there, they found that there was no room for public nuisance suits because of the authority that we've been discussing today. EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act, Section 111, displaces any federal common law right to seek emission reductions from power plants. It said in that case that the decision of whether and how to reduce emissions from power plants was left to EPA. Of course, in West Virginia, we're seeing that the how has now been a bit constrained. Interestingly, in West Virginia, you saw Edison Electric and other power companies submit an amicus brief on EPA's side. They were arguing that EPA does have authority under Section 111. They wanted to avoid opening power companies back up to these public nuisance suits. The other cases that we've seen are the public trust cases. A case called Juliana that folks might be familiar with is a group of young folks who have tried to force climate action under that doctrine. And, you know, they've hit roadblocks. The courts have found that they lack standing. So I honestly don't see this Supreme Court as a particularly hospitable place to force climate protection.
Which brings us back to Congress yet again, all roads do. Shane, what is your final thought here on the courts as a system for advancing climate change, and any final thoughts on where you think it leads us today?
Yeah, I mean, I think advocates will always use the courts to the extent possible. You win some, you lose some, but they have made, you know, great gains in the courts in the past decades as well. You know, my personal view, whether at the state level or the federal level, is that I would like to see our elected representatives who have to face the voters, you know, whether it's every 2 years, every 6 years, whatever, you know, the system is in any given state, have to make some of these decisions and put some systems in place. And then the court's job really is to interpret those laws and interpret the powers delegated, in the case of the Supreme Court, also, you know, the Constitution itself. But I think people will continue to use the courts, and there are probably really good occasions to do that. I think most policymaking is going to have to be done in Congress. And Julia, I've been a broken record since you've known me, but I've always said part of the reason I want this to be dealt with in Congress rather than through the agencies is that I want it to be done with. I want to have a system in place that's durable, a system in place that investors and clean energy deployers and environmental advocates and everyone can actually rely on, because it's enacted into law. And it's pretty, just like it's difficult to enact laws, it's pretty darn hard to repeal them. You face the same obstacles as you do to enacting them. And so I really want to see a smart, thoughtful climate plan put in place by Congress and not have to rely on agencies and courts. But I just don't think that's going to happen in the coming weeks and months. And so for that reason, the courts will continue to play a role every time there's a disagreement about what the law does or doesn't permit.
Right. I think that's marrying the political reality with this more intellectual exercise around what the court decision means and, you know, who has the authority to act next. Reality is we are in quite a gridlocked environment. So getting some broad sweeping energy bill will be difficult. And so we're glad to have experts like Jay come break down for us what kinds of actions EPA can still take. And it sounds like there will be more coming from the Biden administration on that. So something to look out for. Jay, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Thanks. Great discussion.
Thanks so much to everyone for listening. I'm Julia Piper, joined by Shane Skelton. Our editor is Kyle McDonald. Our producer is Maria Virginia Alano. Political Climate is supported by the USC Schwarzenegger Institute and distributed by Canary Media. Thank you so much for listening. While you're here, hit follow or subscribe. It really means a lot. And we also love it when you leave a review. Thank you. We'll be back soon.